Imagine, if you will, that you are just sitting in your local church on a Sunday evening.
Right, just settling into the pews.
Exactly. You are settling in, and you are listening to the standard everyday announcements. There is an update about an upcoming kids' carnival.
Pretty standard stuff.
Very standard.
Yeah.
A very specific request goes out for small ribeye steaks. There are strict reminders to avoid bringing peanut butter to an event.
Because of allergies, I imagine.
Right. It feels entirely familiar, safe, and routine. And interspersed with that routine is a somber, grounded prayer request regarding a tragic mass shooting in Louisiana.
Oh, involving the 8 young children?
Yes, involving 8 young children. It is a moment of genuine community grief.
And it is the exact kind of grounding you expect in a local congregation. I mean, it roots the listener in their immediate community before any of the theological work even begins.
But then, almost immediately after the opening prayer, the message aggressively pivots.
It is quite the shift.
It really is. It shifts from those neighborhood concerns directly into a dense apocalyptic exposition on a global ancient religious conspiracy.
Right into the deep end.
Literally within minutes, that same sermon is telling you that global politics, the Catholic Church, and even a neighboring church's diversity program are all part of an unbroken demonic conspiracy, one that dates all the way back to the Tower of Babel.
Which is an astounding leap.
It is. Welcome to the deep dive.
Yeah.
Today, we are analyzing a striking and intense sermon transcript from a YouTube channel called New Life Benson. The message, which was delivered by Brother Steve on April 19th, 2026, is titled The Fall of the World, The Mystery Religion.
And before we get into the architecture of this worldview, we need to establish our parameters clearly.
Absolutely.
We are strictly examining the theological interpretations, the historical claims, and the modern critiques exactly as they're presented by the speaker in this specific source material.
Right. We are just mapping this out.
Exactly. We are not endorsing these viewpoints, nor are we taking sides regarding Catholicism, modern church politics, or any of the cultural issues raised.
Just to be completely clear on that.
Right. Our goal is simply to map out how this speaker constructs his arguments to help you, the listener, understand the mechanics of his worldview.
And that is a critical distinction, because the worldview presented here is massive in its scope. I mean, the contrast between those opening announcements and the core message is incredibly sharp.
It is a deliberate rhetorical strategy.
Right. The speaker, Brother Steve, is laying the foundation for a grand narrative. He argues that there is not a multitude of different false religions in the world.
He says there is just one.
Exactly. He claims there is one singular mystery religion that has existed since ancient times. And he traces its origin to a very specific biblical event.
The Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
And this origin point is essential to the rest of his argument. He introduces Nimrod, the leader of Babel, and his wife. He refers to her as Semiramis, the Queen of Babel. According to the historical narrative Steve presents, Semiramis was the architect of a religious system centered entirely around herself and her son, Tammuz.
And the birth story of Tammuz is fascinating because it sets up the core theme of the entire sermon.
It really does.
Semiramis claimed that Tammuz was not conceived by a human father. She claimed he was conceived by a sunbeam.
Which sounds like ancient mythology.
It does, but for the speaker, this is not just mythology. He frames it as an early, deliberate, satanic counterfeit of the virgin birth of Jesus Christ.
So he is arguing that the deception was planned millennia in advance.
Exactly. And the narrative continues with Tammuz eventually being killed by a wild boar.
Right.
Which leads his mother Semiramis to weep for him for 40 days.
Now, the challenge the speaker faces here is connecting this single, isolated cult in ancient Babel to the rest of global history.
To understand how Steve makes that connection, think of it like a massive millennia-long game of telephone.
A game of telephone, right.
The core of his argument is that when God scattered the people at the Tower of Babel, they took this mother-child cult with them across the globe.
They packed it up and took it with them.
Precisely. And as they dispersed, the names of the mother and child simply morphed to fit new geographic regions and languages.
It is a brilliant rhetorical device. I mean, by using the biblical dispersion at Babel as the mechanism, he accounts for every major pagan mythology in history.
Right. So in his outline, the mother, Semiramis, becomes Ishtar in Assyria.
Okay.
In Egypt, she becomes Isis. In Greece, she is known as Aphrodite. And in Rome, she becomes Venus.
All the same figure, according to him.
Exactly. And the sun, Tammuz, goes through a similar transformation. In Phoenicia, he becomes Baal.
And Steve specifically associates Baal with horrific, fiery baby sacrifices.
Right? He does. And then in Greece, Tammuz is Eros, and in Rome, he is Cupid. But the speaker insists, underneath all the linguistic changes, it is all the exact same religion.
If we look at the psychology behind this theological framework, it is highly effective.
How so?
Well, by categorizing all of these disparate global mythologies, not as human attempts to understand the divine.
It is deliberate satanic counterfeits.
Exactly. Engineered to confuse humanity. The speaker builds an impenetrable ideological fortress.
That makes a lot of sense.
In this view, history is an active, ongoing spiritual war. A singular demonic deception is just wearing different cultural masks to distract from the true story of Christ.
It creates an absolute us versus the world dynamic for the congregation.
Entirely.
But, you know, for a congregation sitting in the pews in 2026, ancient Babel does not feel like an immediate threat.
No, it feels very distant.
So to make this relevant, the transcript follows a very specific geographic timeline. It tracks how this Babylonian religion allegedly traveled from the ancient world directly into modern-day institutions.
Right. Following the destruction of Babylon by the Medes and the Persians, the speaker asserts that the high priests and priestesses of this mystery religion had to relocate.
Where did they go?
He traces their movement to Pergamos, a city in modern-day Turkey. And he makes a point to mention that the Book of Revelation explicitly refers to Pergamos as Satan's throne.
Wait, hold on. Let me jump in here for a second, because the historical leap he makes next is really jarring.
It is quite a jump.
From Pergamos, the timeline moves to Rome. And the catalyst for this move, according to the source, is Julius Caesar.
Right.
How does the speaker get from a ruined ancient city in the Middle East to a Roman emperor adopting this system? Does he explain the mechanism of how that transfer actually happened?
He does, and he roots it in pure political utility.
Okay.
Stinn explains that Julius Caesar brought this false religion to Rome because he understood a fundamental political reality. A conqueror needs a religious system to control the populace.
Nahaki.
It is the ultimate fusion of political ambition and spiritual deception. The speaker details that upon arriving in Rome, the chief priest of this system assumed a very specific title.
Pontifex Maximus.
Exactly.
And this is where the historical claims become incredibly pointed. Steve claims that Pontifex Maximus originally designated the chief priest of Dagon.
The fish god.
The fish god, right. He argues that this was an emperor's title, deeply rooted in pagan worship, long before it was ever associated with Christianity.
Which brings us directly to his critique of modern religious institutions.
This is the core of it.
He asserts that the title Pontifex Maximus was eventually adopted by the Pope. From this, he builds his central argument.
That the Catholic Church is not the direct successor of the Apostle Peter.
Exactly, but is instead the direct successor of this Babylonian mystery religion.
If you are listening to this and wondering how a global Christian denomination connects to a Babylonian queen, you are certainly not alone.
It is a massive claim.
The sheer scale of this historical reinterpretation is astounding. I mean, he is essentially erasing centuries of traditional church history and replacing it with a continuous line of pagan conspiracy.
He is aggressively redefining the boundaries of what constitutes legitimate Christianity. And he provides very specific examples to bolster this claim, tracing Catholic doctrines directly back to his version of Babel.
Let us examine those specific examples. He claims that the Catholic ritual of offering wafers during communion is a direct continuation of offering wafers to the Queen of Babel.
Right.
And he asserts that the 40 days of Lent do not originate from Christ's time in the wilderness.
Oh.
No. He says they originate from the 40 days that Samarema spent weeping for her slain son, Tammuz.
He also targets the concept of purgatory. He describes it historically as a post-death purification place where people could literally buy their relatives' way into heaven.
A financial mechanism.
Exactly. In his framework, this was simply a mechanism engineered by the Babylonian system to enrich the religious institution.
But perhaps his strongest critique is aimed at the veneration of Mary.
This is a major point for him.
It is. He explicitly connects the Catholic title for Mary, the Queen of Heaven, to the Old Testament. He references Jeremiah chapter 44, verses 15 through 18.
And what does that passage say?
Well, for those who might not have the book of Jeremiah memorized, this is a specific passage where the Israelites are condemned by God for burning incense to a pagan deity called the Queen of Heaven.
I see.
For Brother Steve, this text is irrefutable proof that the Catholic Church has amalgamated Christian thought with ancient pagan worship.
This historical mapping serves a dual purpose. I mean, it explains the past, but more importantly for the speaker's audience, it sets the stage for the prophetic future.
Right.
This ancient Babylonian system is the foundational infrastructure for the end times prophecies found in the book of Revelation.
Which marks a significant pivot in the sermon. We move from mapping the past to mapping eschatology.
Which is just the theological term for the study of the end of the world.
According to the source, how does this mystery religion factor into the end times?
The speaker introduces the key eschatological players. There is the Antichrist, whom he identifies as the beast,
okay,
the false prophet, and a 10-nation confederacy, which he describes as a revived Roman Empire.
The description of the false prophet is incredibly vivid here. Steve quotes Revelation, describing a beast coming out of the earth that has two horns like a lamb, that speaks like a dragon.
The visual contrast there is striking.
It is. He emphasizes that the false prophet looks gentle, but he is fluent in the language of Satan.
And the interpretation of this figure's role is quite practical within the context of global deception.
It is. The phrasing Steve uses here is brilliant in its modern relatability.
How so?
He characterizes the false prophet as the Antichrist's PR man.
The PR man.
The public relations representative for global evil. He performs great signs. He makes fire come down from heaven, and even gives breath to a giant statue of the Antichrist so that it can speak.
Fascinating.
And the singular goal of this supernatural PR campaign is to mandate worldwide worship of the Antichrist.
Which brings us to a critical juncture in the speaker's timeline, the double cross.
Ah, yes.
Steve maps out a very specific two-phase process for the end times. Phase one occurs during a period called the tribulation,
which in this theological framework is a future period of unprecedented global suffering and divine judgment.
Right. During this first phase, the political system, meaning the Antichrist and his confederacy, uses this false mystery religion to unify and control the global masses.
So the political beast rides the harlot of false religion, to use the biblical imagery, but the alliance is temporary.
Exactly. Temporary. In phase two, once the political system has achieved total control, it consumes and destroys the mystery religion.
It turns on it.
It does. The political beast realizes it no longer needs the false religion. It eradicates it entirely, replacing it with the direct mandated worship of the Antichrist himself.
It is a bleak vision, honestly. Deception layered upon deception. However, the speaker does not leave his audience in despair.
He offers a resolution.
He does. He concludes this prophetic segment with a vision of final victory. He references Revelation 19, painting a picture where Christ returns, riding a white horse.
Right.
And following him are the armies of heaven, which Steve identifies as the church and the martyrs. They are dressed in fine, clean white linen, riding white horses alongside him to ultimately defeat the Antichrist and this entire world system.
It is the necessary triumphant resolution to the dark, conspiratorial timeline he has constructed. But what is truly vital to understand about this sermon...
That he brings it to the present?
Yes. He does not leave these concepts in the ancient past or in the distant prophetic future. He brings the threat of the mystery religion right into the immediate present.
Yes. This is where the theology becomes an active modern critique. How does Brother Steve see the seeds of this mystery religion operating in churches right now in 2026?
He argues that the foundation for this global deception is currently being laid through the compromise of modern theology. He makes a rather sweeping claim that theology in America is going down the drain. He asserts that there are fewer than 10 good seminaries left in the country that actually teach the Bible, rather than just teaching human opinion.
Wow, well, I should say that is quite an assertion. To illustrate this present-day threat, he plays a video during the sermon.
Right, the video from Dr. Thomas W. Rush.
Yes, and it focuses on a specific real-world congregation, East Lake Community Church, in Irmo, South Carolina. Steve points out that this is a member of the Southern Baptist Convention.
The critiques he levels against this church are severe, and they illuminate exactly what he considers to be the modern manifestations of the mystery religion.
He highlights three main issues. First, he attacks their big tent philosophy.
For anyone unfamiliar, what does he mean by big tent?
A big tent philosophy is the idea that a church can tolerate differing beliefs among its members on secondary issues while remaining unified on the core gospel.
I see.
But for Steve, this big tent is not a sign of grace. It is a sign of dangerous doctrinal compromise. He argues it breaks down the strict boundaries required to resist demonic deception.
Second, he focuses on the church's social action programs. He specifically critiques their intentional focus on multiculturalism and racial reconciliation.
The transcript notes that Eastlake Community Church replaced traditional classes on racism with classes on gracism.
And Steve is highly critical of this.
Extremely. In his framework, such social programs are merely secular philosophies masquerading as theology. They are designed to distract the church from its true biblical mandate.
The third and perhaps most forceful critique centers on the role of women in church leadership. He highlights that Eastlake Community Church has female elders and female pastors.
He specifically names a Pastor Michelle shown in the video.
Right. This connects back to an earlier moment in the sermon where Steve firmly cited 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 12.
For those who might not know the reference, this is the specific passage historically used to demand a strict complementarian view.
Meaning men and women have distinct, separate roles.
Exactly. And specifically, that women cannot hold pastoral authority over men in the church. He is incredibly frustrated that a church with a female pastor is allowed to remain within the Southern Baptist Convention.
His conclusion regarding the Southern Baptist Convention is quite cynical. He asserts that the denomination is too concerned with the financial contributions of large churches to enforce strict doctrine.
They will not expel congregations that deviate from these traditional interpretations, basically.
That is his argument.
So we see the complete arc of his argument, and the utility of this worldview becomes crystal clear.
It really does.
By branding everything outside his specific theology as a Babylonian counterfeit, the speaker creates a system where disagreement is essentially impossible.
Because if you disagree, you are part of the conspiracy.
Exactly. If another church focuses on diversity or has a female pastor, it is not just a difference of opinion on how to run a church. It is an active manifestation of the mystery religion.
It is a demonic deception paving the way for the Antichrist.
The spiritual warfare for Brother Steve is happening in the pews and in the denominational headquarters right now.
The Babylonian system is currently working to dilute the truth, preparing the world for the ultimate deception.
It is an incredible journey he takes his congregation on. I mean, in a single Sunday evening message, he weaves together Nimrod, the ancient king of Babel,
the title of the modern pope,
an end times public relations false prophet, and a modern South Carolina church's diversity program. He connects them all into one continuous, unbroken narrative of cosmic spiritual warfare.
Every piece of data, whether it is ancient history or modern church politics, is filtered through the singular lens of an ongoing satanic counterfeit religion.
Which brings us to a final thought to leave you with today. We have mapped out a worldview that sees an ancient, constantly evolving counterfeit religion operating behind the scenes, aiming to deceive the entire world.
Right.
If a community genuinely believes they are living in the shadow of that kind of cosmic deception, how does that fundamentally change the way they view their neighbors?
How does it alter their perception of cultural shifts and social institutions?
What happens to a community's capacity for trust when everything outside of a very narrow, strict doctrinal definition is viewed not just as a different opinion, but as an active part of a demonic conspiracy?
That is a profound question about the sociology of belief. It really highlights the lingering tension at the heart of this kind of theological framework.
It certainly does. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material. We will be back next time to explore another fascinating subject.